Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Among the many mysteries surrounding autism are these. Why is it so much more common in boys? And why is it that girls who are affected seem more likely to suffer severe symptoms, including intellectual disability? The short answer may be that we're asking the wrong questions based on the wrong assumptions. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. While children diagnosed with autism spectrum disorders are indeed at least four times more likely to be boys, that may be because our definition of what autism looks like has been based on what it looks like in boys. And it may be that a range of challenges in girls, from OCD to anorexia, are in fact rooted in the autism spectrum. Maya Solovitz is a science journalist and author. Her article, Autism, It's Different in Girls, appears in the March issue of Scientific American Mind. Maya, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
How did definitions of what autism is come to be based essentially on what had been observed in boys?
Well, that's actually true for most of medicine, and it's especially true for autism because boys' symptoms seem to be much more obvious.
Yeah, I was thinking reading your article about heart disease and how for a long time women didn't know when they were having heart attacks because we'd been taught the classic symptoms of men's heart attacks.
Exactly. It's quite similar.
So which of those hallmark symptoms in boys may be absent or manifest differently in girls who have autism?
Well, one of the things that a lot of people look for in very young children is, do they pretend when they're playing? And specifically, do they pretend to be other people like Superman or Batman or something like that? Autistic boys don't tend to have pretend play. So what they tend to do is just, you know, spin car wheels and line up blocks and stuff like that. Girls play with dolls, and oftentimes one of the people I spoke with for the article talked about how she would line up her Barbies as if they were having a wedding, but she wasn't pretending to be the bride or the bridesmaid or anything like that. She was just pretending that she was photographing the wedding, so she wasn't actually imagining herself as a different person.
How interesting. So, but if someone walked in the room and saw her playing with those dolls, they would assume that that was sort of regular pretend play for a little girl.
Exactly. And girls' special interests, autistic people tend to have special interests like a sort of obsessive interest in, the typical example has been trains or computers or math. Girls tend to have more typical girl obsessions. So it might be Barbies or Disney or things like that that don't seem as far out of the norm. What seems out of the norm for them is the intensity of the interest.
So based on diagnoses, doctors may simply have overlooked a lot of girls who are affected by milder forms of autism. Is that what you've learned?
Yeah, because there was a study which was done which looked at what you needed to get a diagnosis. And for the same level of autistic traits, girls needed to either have intellectual disability or to have severe behavioral symptoms to get diagnosed. So it was very clear that girls at the higher end of the spectrum are getting missed.
You write in the piece about one mom who has a son and a daughter, both on the autism spectrum. The experiences in getting them diagnosed was starkly different for her.
Yes. With the girl, everybody kept telling her, it's not autism, it's not autism, she's a girl, you know, maybe she has this diagnosis, maybe she has that diagnosis. They gave her all sorts of, oh, she's just, you know, developing slowly, this is normal. And it wasn't, the irony there is that her husband is one of the leading autism specialists in the world, and he didn't even see it.
So is there something harder to spot in mild autism in girls? Is it actually less severe than mild autism in boys, or is it simply that girls are somehow better at not revealing those symptoms?
Yes, girls tend to hide it a lot better. And basically what girls tend to do is to try to hack socializing. So they, you know, autistic people tend to be better at systematic thinking than at socializing. And so the girls just bring their very brilliant, often systemizing sort of brains to socializing. And so they look like they're behaving like other girls, but they are actually, you know, inside, it's an enormous amount of anxiety, an enormous amount of effort just to be able to basically play that role.
You introduced us in the piece to a woman named Jennifer O'Toole who didn't realize she herself was on the spectrum until adulthood. You know that it would be hard for people who meet her to guess that she had ever struggled.
Yes, well, she... it's interesting. Meeting a lot of women on the spectrum, you just, for most of them, you would not know. And I think girls and women in general tend to hide their behavior more. So when, in school, girls with learning problems and emotional difficulties tend to be much more hidden because they're quiet about it, whereas boys really display symptoms. And this we see with autism as well.
So Jennifer O'Toole made it a practice of studying the way other people did things, how they reacted to things, so she could pass herself off as unaffected. She didn't know she had autism, but she knew somehow that she felt different than everybody else.
Yes, she had a lot of anxiety, and she was always feeling like she didn't quite fit and that she wasn't quite right. And so it was amazing because she was in a sorority. She was actually going out with the president of a fraternity. She looked for all the world like there was nothing going on. But inside, and this is the case for a lot of people with anorexia at first, too, inside there's all this stuff going on that under that perfect sort of looking surface, is sort of bubbling up there.
Let's talk about that possible link between anorexia and autism. It's not a link that we associate specifically with boys who have autism. So why would girls with anorexia, how was that link discovered?
Well, basically, on the surface, the conditions look completely different. But when you look at the actual characteristics of the conditions, both of them share a lot in common, and one of the main things that they share is a sort of compulsive rigidity, attention to detail, not liking anything to change, trying to make sure the environment stays the same, and a lot of anxiety. And so what may be going on in some girls is that they turn the sort of obsessive special interest that autism makes people prone to onto eating and food, which is culturally sanctioned for women to do. And so, Jennifer O'Toole actually had this happen, and she had like spreadsheets of how many calories she could have, all kinds of things like this.
And I wonder if for some of these young women that, at first the dieting starts to seem like something that will connect you with your peers, right? Because it's something that a lot of teenage girls often, unfortunately, become a little bit obsessed with.
No, exactly. It seems very unfortunately like a very typical interest. And so, they can get connected with people. They can have something, an obsession that they can talk about that they will be able to, other people will understand. So, yes.
So reading your piece, Maya, I came to actually have a great deal of admiration for girls on the milder end of the spectrum who cope so well that they might, escape diagnosis. On the other hand, it occurred to me that they're missing out on maybe extra help that would allow them to adapt and navigate their environments and sort of be more comfortable in their own skins.
Yeah, no. Well, I actually am a person who probably would have been diagnosed with Asperger's, the mild form of autism that no longer is in the DSM, as a child. And for me, it was very liberating to find out about autism and about what it was, because it explained why I was so obsessive about everything and why I had like all these sensory problems where I didn't like tastes or smells or sounds or lights, and why everything felt so difficult and why I felt like I was like selfish and controlling because I just had a harder time managing the environment. I feel like if that diagnosis had been available at the time, I might not have decided I was a bad person. I might have just thought, oh, I have this, this problem and there's other people that have it and there's all kinds of things like that. So I think getting the label can be very liberating for people. When I interviewed Jennifer, she talked about how she was sitting outside in her car after her kids got diagnosed and when she was waiting to find out about her own, like praying that she would indeed be diagnosed. Mm.
How old were you when you thought, I don't know if you read symptoms or did some research and thought, that sounds like me?
This has got to have been in my 20s or 30s. Mm. And that's actually pretty typical, I found out from interviewing a bunch of women on the spectrum for this piece. A lot of times people get diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder, which I did get. A lot of people get diagnosed with depression, which I did get. A lot of people get diagnosed with ADHD, which I did get. And so, you know, for a lot of women, autism is a lot sadder than it seems to be for men and boys, because women often, and this is not true for all women on the spectrum, but for many women on the spectrum, they desperately, desperately, desperately want to connect, but they can't, and they're really bad at it. And you can imagine how horrible that is. Whereas in boys, they just seem to be less interested in socializing, so they don't care as much that they don't have friends. And again, this is a generalization, so there are some men on the spectrum who really do care and some women who are more like the men, but it is definitely much more painful to be aware of something that you can't do and care about it than it is to be unaware of something and just not care.
I'm so glad that you bring this up. And we've had other folks on the show who have been on the autism spectrum who have pointed this out. There seems to be this misconception among the general population that if you're on the spectrum, you're okay with a lot less social interaction.
And I mean, that can be true in the sense of that people tend to be quite introverted. And I mean, I have a good friend who, you know, the more social life, the better. She can never get enough of people. And me, I need a certain amount of socialization, but after that, it's enough and I have to go and be by myself.
How does the brain of a girl with mild autism compare with the brain of a neurotypical boy?
Well, see, this was what was really fascinating about Kevin Pelfrey's research, which I told about in the story. Basically, what it looks like is that girls look more like typical age boys than they do like autistic boys. And so it may be, you know, it almost looks like a delay.
So a delay in the development of social skills?
Yes, yes. And I mean, it's interesting because we now know that sort of different parts of the brain tend to grow at different times. And so if you have some kind of developmental difference there, and socialization doesn't interest you until much later than it interests other girls, you may have a real hard time catching up.
Yeah. And then, you know, you get into, as you note in the article, adolescence, middle school comes along, there's the mean girls factor, and then, you know, social, you know, being just like everybody else matters for those few years more than it ever has or ever will.
No, I mean, that was absolutely the worst time of my life. It was horrifying. And because actually, as a much younger child, I had sort of had a bunch of intellectual obsessions ranging from like opera to science fiction. And I was just really, really wrapped up in all of those. And I didn't, you know, I wanted friends and I was sad about not having friends, but I wasn't as desperately miserable as I was when I hit junior high and I was like, you know, maybe had two friends, couldn't, you know, it was just awful.
And did your parents have a sense of how to help you?
No, really not at all. I mean, the thing is, and this is the case in Jennifer's case as well, autistic girls who are also gifted, everybody focuses on the intellectual development and not so much on the social.
Right.
And so this is another place where the missing autistic girls hide. A lot of gifted girls also have autism spectrum symptoms, and they hide them, and it makes it very difficult for them to socialize.
We're speaking this hour with science journalist Maya Solovitz. Her article, Autism, It's Different in Girls, appears in the March issue of Scientific American Mind. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with science journalist Maya Solovitz. Her article, Autism, It's Different in Girls, appears in the March issue of Scientific American Mind. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So is the brain function that allows for typical socialization among boys problematic when girls have it? In other words, if girls are sort of at the level of neurotypical boys, but they are on the autism spectrum, you can get by, right? So explain why it's harder for girls to have a brain that functions a little more like a boy's in social interactions.
Well, basically, girls throughout pretty much of life are 2 years ahead of boys socially. Mm-hmm. And that's like at the moderate end of the limit. So if you are 2 years behind your peers socially, it can be pretty awful, especially when you're talking about ages like junior high.
Yeah. So as an adult, if you don't mind me asking this question, Maya, as an adult who now identifies as being on the spectrum, if someone says to you, I couldn't tell, is that a compliment? Does that come at you like, well, what is that supposed to mean? How do you feel about that?
It's interesting. I think I do like this movement by people with autism called neurodiversity, mm-hmm. where the idea is that there's a huge spectrum of human wiring and that all different types of wiring have both advantages and disadvantages. And so I prefer, like, it is certainly the case that autism can be profoundly disabling and nobody is saying that we don't want to mitigate people's disabilities. We just also want to see that autistic people can bring strengths and gifts and all kinds of other stuff just like any person can. So I think, you know, when people say it, it's always a little weird. And it's been very interesting because I'm a journalist, so I interview a lot of people. And when I interview people in the autism world, nobody disbelieves me. But when I interview people outside the autism world, they almost always do. So it's quite interesting that way.
Like people outside the autism world maybe don't have a clear understanding of the range of, you know, personalities that can fit under that umbrella?
Yeah, and I think there has typically been this idea that autistic people cannot empathize, so that it means that autistic people aren't warm or compassionate and don't want connection. And that actually isn't the case. There's two parts of empathy. One part is the knowing how other people feel, and the other part is being able to respond to how other people feel. Hmm. Autistic people have the problem with knowing how other people feel, and we care about how other people feel once we know that they are upset. But often because of our own sensory issues, we don't perceive that. And so you will get like an autistic kid seeing somebody crying and saying, why is she making that funny noise? And it's not because she has no compassion. It's because she doesn't understand that that's an expression of emotion. And when autistic people do understand that, they can be as compassionate and warm and connected as everybody else. But because there's sort of confusion about these two types of empathy, like sociopathic people have... they can know what other people are feeling, but they do not care.
Yeah.
And those people are scary. And there has unfortunately been a confusion with autism and sociopathy regarding empathy.
All right, let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Maria calling from Dallas. Hi, Maria.
Hi. I wanted to know if there was a difference between behavior, autism, and just autism. I don't know how to explain that. Could autism be caused by the environmental behavior, or
you mean is it nature or nurture? Is that what you're asking, Maria?
Yeah, is it nature or nurture?
What do we know about that, Maya?
It pretty much overwhelmingly seems to be nature. There was an unfortunate period in the history of autism where mothers were blamed for making their children autistic.
Refrigerator
and there
mothers.
Was this, exactly. And that is absolutely not the case. Autism is not caused by poor parenting. Is it possible that, there are chemicals in the environment or things that influence the way the fetus develops. For example, people who have, when mothers have infections while pregnant, with things like flu, their children have a higher risk of being autistic and also a higher risk of being schizophrenic. So the, you know, those kinds of things may be the thing that distinguishes between the person whose autism-related genes manifest themselves as autism and those whose autism-related genes do not. That said, what often happens with autism and social development, at least as far as I've seen, is that if you're not interested in social life early on, you can sort of miss a whole bunch of developmental cues at a time when your brain is very sensitive to them. And in the case of language, if you do that, you may be sort of permanently impaired in ever learning language if you don't hear it as a baby. And so if you sort of cut yourself off from social stimuli when you're trying to deal with overwhelming sensory input as a child, you may sort of miss that developmental period. And so in that case, there may be an environmental aspect, but that is definitely not poor parenting. And it is actually a useful thing because if you know that a child has these tendencies, you can probably mitigate some of the sensory distress, figure out why people are doing the repetitive behavior and why they are, withdrawn, and make it easier for them to interact before they miss that stuff. And then they may have less problems with socializing later in life. They will still have the autistic wiring, but it will be less disabling.
Maya, I completely understand how it could be exhausting for a girl with autism to mask her symptoms, whether deliberately or simply as a way that she's found of coping in the world socially. Is it detrimental for people to conceal their autism symptoms?
I think it can be. I mean, I think that, you know, there's a event that I've never been to, but it's called Autreat, where people who are autistic can go and be as autistic as they like. And they wear badges that say if it's okay to talk to them or if it's only okay to talk to them if they approach you first. People are sitting around doing, you know, stimulation behaviors. They are just being exactly as they are. And as you might imagine, that can be really, really liberating, where you can just be accepted and you don't have to explain to other people. I mean, I think it's kind of almost like any other being a part of any other culture. Like if you're somewhere where your culture is oppressed or suppressed, and then you go to a place where, you know, it's okay to be who you are, it's kind of amazing.
Yeah, it seems like it might be really instructive. Not that people at Autreat want, you know, neurotypicals coming and invading one more place, but it might be interesting for a small minority of neurotypical people to go there and get a sense for what it feels like to be one of the only people whose brain works the way yours works.
Well, I mean, I got a very, very tiny taste of this. I'm straight and I went to Fire Island in the 90s and, you know, the very gay areas. And it was like, it immediately made me realize like how strange it is to, be that minority.
Huh.
And obviously we can all talk about various areas of privilege where, you know, people just are not aware of how, you know, sort of dominant and oppressive their majority is until they find themselves as a minority.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372. Allison is on the line in Denton. Hi, Allison.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question about communication. I know that that's one of the major differences between boys and girls, and one of the reasons why girls often go undetected. As a child, I had autistic symptoms, and they chalked it up to things like shyness, or they used terms like a selective mutism back then. But I eventually did adapt and learn to interact socially, but it was more of like a separate task, sort of like a strategy, like you mentioned before. One of the things that I think was helpful is I have a sibling who is only a year older, and I know that in some cases, having an older sibling who is unaffected and socially functional is helpful and can actually help the autistic child adapt. And we were close enough in age to when I had stopped speaking. We were in the same, you know, Montessori class and everything. And I'm wondering how much of that might be a crutch, where you have this sort of ambassador who introduces you to the world, which is helpful, or if it can actually hinder you and keep you from developing those skills more quickly, and how that might differ between boys and girls.
That is a really interesting question. I tend to think, I mean, we know from sort of overwhelming evidence in psychology in general that social support is basically the thing that relieves stress, makes you happy, makes you healthy, et cetera, et cetera. That said, if you are too sheltered and you don't, you know, sort of push your own comfort zone a little bit, yeah, you might end up missing out on certain things. This is, like, I think probably the biggest challenge that parents have, like, when do you push and when do you say, okay, this is actually a limitation that we need to respect because it's just going to get the person upset trying to make them, you know, go past it. And I mean, this issue arises in trauma treatment. It arises in education. It's really difficult because basically the answer is it depends and every person is going to be different. I think, you know, girls do just tend to be more socially inclined, so I bet they would benefit more from that. But I actually think that would be a really interesting thing to study. Also comparing, like, autistic kids who are the oldest, as I was, to those who do have, you know, siblings.
You note that high-functioning girls with autism can really benefit from help with what might strike people as trivial during adolescence, things like wardrobe and personal hygiene. People with sensory issues might really struggle with wearing appropriate clothing, for example, or knowing how to sort of pull things together.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you don't pick up on social cues, it's very hard to get fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the program that I write about, it's called Girls Night Out. They take, it seems like a really wonderful thing where they have neurotypical girls who act as mentors for autistic girls, and they help them with, you know, questions about dating or questions about, you know, what to wear. And yes, sensory issues often make people, like, not want to take showers, not want to wear bras, do things that are not going to be very helpful to your social life. So teaching those things can be really, really important. I just wanted to mention here, Jennifer O'Toole actually has a book called Sisterhood of the Spectrum, which, you know, sort of offers tips and this kind of stuff to other people who might benefit from them. So I think that might be a useful resource because, unfortunately, like, Girls Night Out, and I'm now going to space out where they are located, but they are one small program, and it was only very recently that any services have become available for women on the spectrum. In fact, New York City has a place called Felicity House, which is the first sort of clubhouse, art space place for women on the spectrum to come and be that really exists, I think, in the world.
Let's jump back on the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Trish is on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Trish.
Hi, how are you, Chris?
Very well.
Hi, Maya.
Hi.
I just want to say this is probably one of the best interviews I've ever heard relating to autism-related things, and thank you so much for putting all this out there. It's fantastic.
Thanks.
And my question is, do you have any thoughts on how to help the medical community get past the stereotypes in terms of barriers to diagnosis? I know another one, obviously, besides the you're female, you can't be autistic, is also, well, they're social, they can't be autistic. And I know that's a big one that throws just your generic pediatrician off, and it's not true. It's not a consistent marker for autism. Can you speak to how we might be able to help the medical community get past that?
Thanks for your call.
Well, I think one of the things that the DSM-5 actually did get right is that they have now included the sensory symptoms as primary, as sort of key to diagnosing autism, because I've never met somebody on the spectrum that doesn't have some type of sensory sensitivity or oversensitivity or undersensitivity, some kind of sensory difference. And for some people, the sensory differences are what causes the social problems, just because you're so busy dealing with trying to mitigate this sensory difference that you can't pay attention socially. So if you focus on those things that are sort of the most early symptoms, you might be able to get better diagnoses for girls, and you might also be able to help people earlier so that they don't miss social input so much, and so that then they can just connect better in general.
Why are girls with autism thought to be at particular risk for sexual exploitation?
Well, this is like the saddest part of this story, and I have to say I probably experienced some of this. Jennifer O'Toole, again, gave me a great quote. She said, when you don't think you're lovable, you'll love for crumbs. And when one of the things that also puts autistic girls at risk is just that because autistic people tend to be very direct, I want this, they might go up to a boy and say, I want to have sex with you. And this is generally not the courtship technique that is, good for girls,
right.
To put it mildly. And so there, it just can be so disastrous, because if you are autistic, people in general also tend to believe what other people tell them. And so then you would be really naive and, oh, yes, I'll love you forever. And, oh, we only have to hide our relationship because of blah, blah, blah. You'll just fall for stuff that other women would not fall for. And also, on the more disabled part of the spectrum, people with disabilities in general are unfortunately at risk for sexual exploitation anyway. And if you are in some kind of institutional setting or, a place where basically just doesn't get very much oversight, that is unfortunately where a lot of sexual predators tend to go. And so, in residential places, in group homes, in these kinds of things, there's rarely enough money to fund the proper regulatory oversight, and a lot of horrible sexual exploitation does happen. So, this can be a problem across the spectrum.
My guest is science journalist Maya Salovitz. We're talking about her article, Autism, It's Different in Girls, in the March issue of Scientific American Mind.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program, with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with science journalist Maya Salovitz about her article, Autism, It's Different in Girls. You can read it in the March issue of Scientific American Mind. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Lauren, who says, my daughter is 20, and it has crossed our mind a few times that she could have very high-functioning Asperger's, but she doesn't seem textbook by any means. She's now struggling with depression, anxiety, OCD, an eating disorder, and trouble in school. She also has impulse control problems. Now that I'm listening, I think she could be a candidate. What would be my first step in getting her tested? Any thoughts, Maya?
Yes, there are people who do specialize in testing for people on the spectrum. You can find them basically online. I only know people in New York, unfortunately, but you want somebody who is familiar with the range of symptoms that autism can have. The saying in the autism community is, if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a very diverse and difficult. Diagnosis is difficult in general in psychiatry, because the brain is so complicated. And the same gene might develop, might give you a risk for schizophrenia, autism, depression, etc. The other thing that this question brings to mind is that if you can get people diagnosed early and get people help early, you might be able to prevent the things that come secondary, like depression and these some of these other things, because sometimes, like in my case, I developed such a level of self-hatred because I could not fit in and connect that I became depressed. And I feel like if I had sort of known that there wasn't something morally wrong with me, that it would have been a lot easier. But so I think, you know, for you want to seek out somebody who does specialize in autism, ideally somebody who's an academic, maybe at one of the universities nearby, you know, so that you can find the right diagnosis. Of course, then finding the right services is just hard. I mean, our system is just terrible. But, you know, the good thing is that, like, she has you fighting for her and you have an idea that this might be what's wrong. And I do think once you understand, like, how, why these weird symptoms tend to fit together, then it can be liberating because you can sort of come up with, okay, well, I know I have a sensory issue that tends to make me behave this way in this situation. So either I avoid this situation or I mitigate this sensory disability in that situation so that I can behave better. And so that can often help with situations in school or social events. I mean, for me, loud noises are terrible and I really hate loud restaurants. you know, again, like it'll be different things for different people.
And to be clear, I think most people are aware it's not like there's a medication one can take to relieve the symptoms of autism, but with professional help, you might be able to sort of look at specific problematic symptoms and work on those.
Yes, and definitely, like, with the sensory stuff, there's ways of, you know, reducing that. And there's also, I mean, I would also recommend getting in touch with autistic communities online, because a lot of people have, you know, taught themselves how to deal with this stuff, and they're very happy to share that information. Jennifer O'Toole's Ask for Kids website might be useful. There are definitely a lot of resources online that do allow, I mean, I think one of the things that's cool about medicine now is that people with these various conditions can get together and help each other and say, oh, when this happened to me, I did this, you know, and that kind of inside knowledge can be really useful.
You have a book coming out in April about addiction, which is called Unbroken Brain, a revolutionary new way of understanding addiction. It makes the argument that addictions are actually learning disorders. Can you explain how you came to that conclusion and what that might have to do with any link between autistic brains and addicted brains?
Sure, sure. I mean, in my case, what happened was I discovered in high school that if I obsessively talked about drugs, people liked that. And so I became very involved in drugs and ended up selling coke in college. And it became a nightmare and I got addicted to coke and heroin. This is definitely not a path I recommend. One of the main links there for me anyway was just self-medicating.
Mm-hmm.
The drugs, like, allowed me, especially the opioids, allowed me to turn down the volume on the senses. And not that I'm recommending doing this, but it was that, you know, it was a sort of revelation to me that, like, I could be in a way like that. And fortunately, today, I have found for me that SSRI antidepressants also have that turning down the oversensitivity effect, but without the nasty addiction. You know, that, and actually I would recommend, a lot of women have found particularly low doses of SSRIs to be helpful for oversensitivity symptoms in autism. So in writing the book and in sort of thinking about my experience, I realized that just as autism sort of unfolds over development in these sensitive periods when it's important for the brain to get specific input, the same thing is true with addiction. And in particular, when you hit adolescence, your brain is looking for a specific type of social input. And if you're not good at getting that, or if you're overwhelmed, or if you just try to run away with drugs at that time, you miss out on learning certain things, and you also may your brain is especially vulnerable just for biological reasons to drugs at that time. So understanding that 90% of all addictions start in adolescence helps us understand a lot about what it's doing in the brain. And so I just wanted to explore that and also to say that while my story is clearly not exactly typical, there are lots of things that are going on under behaviors that we just label bad, and we need to understand them. And the repetitive behaviors that, you know, people with autism or OCD have, you know, washing your hands compulsively isn't truly very fun. Mm-hmm. You're doing that to, like, relieve anxiety, right? When you become addicted to a drug, that isn't fun either. You're also doing that for a reason. We need to stop focusing so much on let's stop these behaviors and focus more on why are people doing these behaviors? What is making people despair like this? How can we, you know, get them treatment that is useful and not harmful? And how can we sort of understand, like, the supply isn't the issue. The issue is why do 10 to 20% of people who use drugs like coke, heroin, methamphetamine become addicted to the point where their, you know, lives just fall apart? And so if we understand that compulsive behavior, which I had long experience with going back to my earliest childhood, if you understand that, I think you can do a lot better at treating both conditions. Because I think with autism, too, there's been a sort of idea that, like, oh, if we just get people to stop doing self-stimulating behavior, if we just get them to look normal or typical, you know, then we'll have solved the problem. But of course, if you're doing those behaviors in order to be able to function, then stopping those will just make you miserable and it won't really help.
Maya, to take nothing away from the hard work that it surely took for you to overcome your addiction to drugs, I wonder if, looking back, you think there was something about your autistic brain and your embrace of rules and even your sort of compulsive tendencies that was helpful to you when you decided it was time to stop being addicted?
Yes, I think that's true. And I think that, I mean, I got into recovery when I was 23. And that, probably not coincidentally, is when the cortex of the brain, the areas that are involved most critically in self-control, sort of come online. Unfortunately, the areas that are involved in driving you to do things sort of get developed long before the brakes get developed. Mm-hmm. And this is the tragedy of adolescence. But I think that probably one of the things that allowed me to recover when I was that age was that perhaps that was when my brain finally got me enough self-control to be able to stop. I think that, you know, we don't know very much. I've been working on sort of researching articles on this, but we really don't know very much about what risk people with autism have for addictions, because oftentimes their poor social skills makes it impossible for them to actually get the drugs. You know, we need to sort of know more about that, I think. Because I have heard from particularly women on the spectrum about similar self-medication kinds of experiences. But I also think that one of the interesting things about being wired differently in a way that makes you sort of persist despite negative consequences is that if you can direct that in a positive direction, whether it's autistic energy or addictive energy or whatever it is, it can allow you to be very productive and very connected and to, you know, really thrive. It's just if that energy is misdirected at something like anorexia or addiction or, you know, I mean, there's many other things. But if you end up with that, you know, it can really be dangerous. But if you direct it positively, it can really be not just a source of disability, but a source of, you know, talent.
I'm struck by the number of emails we've had from people talking about themselves as women or women they know who feel like this conversation with you sounds like a revelation, like they're recognizing themselves or their loved ones. How often do you meet? Do you meet adult women more often than adult men who say, I think this is me?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I'm just, you know, sort of starting talking about this publicly, so I don't have that much experience with this. But it does seem to be the case that people have been finding Like I wrote a previous article about this theory about autism called the intense world, which is the idea that if you that autism may be more driven by the sensory symptoms than people originally believed. And so that what may happen is that you get overloaded in your senses and then you withdraw and then you miss social input. And that's the problem rather than you having a bad social brain to begin with.
Well, that's interesting.
I think there's obviously many different autisms and that may be one of them. But I do know that it has been, you know, when I meet people who have this experience, it is very, it did for me, like when I remember reading this article in the Times about Asperger's, it's got to be, I mean, probably sometime in the 90s. And I remember, I mean, there was a very silly joke about like the partner of the person who was saying, oh, you're being a real Asperger whenever they were behaving in ways that might not be socially appropriate. But it was, yeah, it was like, wow, like, so much of that is me, and it's so, you know, it does feel so good to feel understood and not to feel like I have this weird collection of things that don't seem to make any sense.
The DSM-5 eliminated the diagnosis of Asperger's and rolled everybody under the autism spectrum disorders, but people who earlier identified or were identified as having Asperger's don't seem to want to let that term go.
Yeah, I mean, and there's probably good and bad reasons for that. The sort of bad stigmatizing reason would be to, you know, distinguish themselves from those really autistic people. Yeah. The good reason would be just that it, you know, there are so many differences anyway. It might be better to be more splitting than lumping at this point. You know, I think the term certainly has been adopted in popular culture and, you know, been recognized as a character that we all know. So, you know, I don't think it's going to actually go away. And I, you know, I mean, I'm, for me, it's just semantics, if you want to say on the autism spectrum or Asperger's. But, you know, I think, you know, you can make arguments both ways. But I think as a diagnosis, it probably should have stayed.
The point you make at the end of the piece is one I love for all sorts of reasons. And that is that on the autism spectrum or not, we need to make more room in our society for women who happen to be socially inept. And I think that it's kind of a beautiful thing to say because there are high expectations on women.
Thanks. Yes. No. Well, I mean, it was, again, it was fascinating to talk to Dr. Pelfrey because he, you know, when we, because I was, you know, just throughout this article, I was questioning, like, you know, what makes women on the autism spectrum different from other women and from men and from men, you know, like all those, you know, what can we learn about autism from women and what can we learn about women from autism? And I think what we can learn about women from autism is that men get away with a heck of a lot of socially inept stuff that women are not allowed to get away with, and we should be.
Maya Solovitz is a science journalist and author. Her article, Autism, It's Different in Girls, appears in the March issue of Scientific American Mind. Maya, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you very much for talking with us.
And thank you. It's been lovely.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy with help on the phones from Tori Whitley. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.